All right, folks, welcome to the Eric Anders Lang Show. I'm sorry, I can't find my microphone or my podcast kit recorder. But don't worry, that's not going to degrade the quality of the conversation that Clay Walker, country star, Texas legend, and famed golfer from the AT&T Pro-Am. Door's opening. Guess there's a ghost in the house. Also, Snowball just ran away, and he's back. So all is well. But anyway, before we get started, want to give a shout out to the partners that make everything that we do possible at Random Golf Club. TaylorMade, obviously they make the best clubs in the biz. Jones Golf Bags, a great place to put those clubs. Headquartered in Portland, Oregon, get your Jones bag today. Weiss Golf Balls, straight out of Munich. That's a rap album that never quite made the charts. But anyway, they make a great golf ball for half the price, and we got a new RGC Vice ball coming out. Precision Pro, best rangefinder in the biz. If you want to get a custom RGC rangefinder with slope and free battery replacement for life, head over to randomgolfclub.com, pick one up. Also, check out a whoop strap. Get your whoop strap, folks, and find out about your body. I learned a lot of things I didn't know. And it's really been an impactful way for me to look at the way I both sleep and, you know, exercise. Also, COVID monitoring device. Need I say more? Okay, anyway, fade me out and let's fade in Clay Walker. And I'll see you at the break for a couple more ad reads, y'all.
It's fine. Everyone did.
What is this room you're in? It looks like you're a lawyer, honestly.
No, I got my Arnold Palmer win right here, the Arnie Award.
I love that.
I got more golf stuff in here than anything. My first hole in one, me at Pebble Beach with my son. Most pictures are golf stuff, you know. I'm a golf junkie like you.
Where was your first hole in one?
My only hole in one was at Falcon Ridge in Kansas City. It was a little 127 yard hole. I hit a pitching wedge and it one hopped in. It was beautiful, just beautiful.
So I guess first of all, thank you. I've been looking forward to this for a while. I'm a big fan of your music, and I'm a big fan of. I feel like, you know, for a long time I lived in Los Angeles and everyone would be surprised that I love country music. And so I love country music. I have for a long time. And I guess.
Yeah. KZLA, man. KZLA.
Exactly. they love it too. So when you go, looking back, like when you, you know, were a young man, like, you know, before you kind of submitted the tape, I'm sure the whole submitting the tape story must be incredible. And I'm sure you've told it 1,000 times. But were you playing golf at that time, or when did it come into your life?
I was poor. You kidding me? I was so poor I couldn't afford to play golf. I mean, plus I grew up in a pasture, you know, raising horses, cattle, and never even saw a golf club. I mean, that was close to a golf club as I ever got was a garden hoe. But I fell in love with the game after my career took off. You know, we were on the road, and you know, I was an athlete all through grade school and high school, and you got all that pent up energy out on the road. I mean, you got to do something with that, right? And so my road manager at the time played golf, and he said, "Man, you might like golf." Went out, and I thought I was going to be really good at it, you know, and because I feel like I'm a good athlete, and I sucked so bad. It was, you know, and I got to tell, I had a temper, man. I would break clubs and stuff. I was just stupid, you know, when I was younger, and I would never break a club now, but. Golly, I broke a lot of clubs in the beginning, and it probably offended a lot of people too. But I was listening to your little there's a 7-minute video of you on YouTube, and my guy that does our video stuff forwarded it to me, and because I said, hey, I want to know a little bit more about Eric. I said, I know he's like, you know, the face of the PGA, blah blah blah. And so I was looking at it, man. You had so many great quotes in that thing, man. It was like. You should just take those quotes and just stack them up for, like, you know, today's listener of your only has about 30 seconds worth of attention span anyway. So
busy.
It fit me so well, man. I mean, like, everything you said just lined up. And anyway, yeah, you're great for the game, man.
Are you? Thank you. I'm honored. Did you see? Were you talking about the deer golf video?
No. Listen, I'll tell you what it is. But this
I'm
is,
curious to know which video it is.
It's worth seeing, man. I mean, it's
seven, I should check it out.
it's 7 minutes, and honestly, I was blown away by it. It's called "How He Made It." It's this one right here. I don't know if it's picking up or not.
How He Made It. I gotta watch that one. I haven't seen that.
But this, some of the quotes in this are honestly. I pay for the non-ad YouTube,
all right.
But yet there's always an ad that comes on.
I'm here to show you nothing else. Golf doesn't suck, and then you should try it.
Oh, you know, this might be my buddy Drew. That's my buddy Drew. Drew. Yeah, so he came out to LA, yeah.
Yeah, the editing on it's great, and I'm curious about one thing. I know this is random, but there's a clip in there of you playing the 18th at St. Andrews. And I played St. Andrews several times. Have you ever made a par on the road hole?
That's a good question. I played the Old Course 3 times. I feel like maybe not. I mean, not memorably. No.
No, it's a no.
That's a no.
I've played probably, 25 times of pros, and I've only seen one make a bar there. So
it's a hard hole. It's a hard hole.
It's so hard. It's so hard.
So where are you right now? Where do you live?
I'm in Nashville. Okay. Well, actually, a little town called Santa Fe, Tennessee. It's about an hour from Nashville. Okay. I'm a Texas boy. Still got a Texas driver's license and still have a place in Texas, and we go back and forth a lot. Probably be a lot more in Texas over the winter, but definitely some great golf courses around here. I belong to a golf club called Golf Club of Tennessee, and yeah. It's a Fazio course, really awesome. I've seen you've played in a lot more countries than I have, by the way, according to that video. But golf is awesome everywhere, and it's so different depending on the terrain you're in. And Tennessee is absolutely stunning in the fall to play golf.
I've only played a little bit in Tennessee. I just moved from LA to Austin, so I'm in Texas now.
Yeah, I hear Austin is the new LA.
Is that what they say?
No,
I don't know if that's good or bad.
All the Californians are moving from California. It's true. Texas, and mostly, Austin is pretty fun. You know, it's high tech and just a lot of diversity there. I think it's probably, the most, well, that in Houston, pretty diverse. But yeah, you like it? Do you like Austin?
I like it so far. Yeah, I want to learn more about being here. Really, I would like, what do you have any advice for being what do you need to know about living in Texas? That's kind of where I'm at right now. It's only been like a couple of weeks.
Well, Texas is called the friendly state, and you're hard pressed to find people who are rude. Most people really are kind, and they love their state. I love my state, obviously. And Texas is welcoming, but you're going to have to live there at least 10 years. Before they consider you a local.
Okay, so I got 10 years left.
You got 10 years before you're a local. And it's the coolest parts about Texas to me are the little towns that surround major cities, like a Dripping Springs, for example. You got to go out there. I shot one of my videos called Dreaming with My Eyes Open in that town when it was nothing, when there was nobody there. And Austin, and people are going to want to shoot me over this one, has the best barbecue. It is. If you have a barbecue place in Austin, Texas, it's going to be great because the competition is so strong, right? Yeah. It's you got to be really. So you're not going to find a bad barbecue spot in Texas. You'll get run out of business.
I'm spoiled.
Yeah, and it's because we have great wood, great oak, post oak, and different kinds of oak. Mesquite even, but Texans are really big about family too. I that it's one state that most people party with their family. I think that's cool, man.
I like that.
To like country that. Music.
Yeah, that's definitely, that's unique. In LA, they're there to get away from their family. So I think a lot of musicians have you talked to a lot of other musicians about the kind of experience of getting into golf and then traveling with your clubs and kind of, bringing the game with you?
Yeah. You know, there's a pretty strong country music contingency that plays golf. You know, when we go out and play, for example, the AT&T at Pebble Beach, you know, happens every year in February, and they have a lot of celebrities and pro golfers play together. And that's pretty much the draw, you know, of the tournament, or the style and setting of the tournament is to have celebrities involved ever since Bing Crosby's day. So when you look across the field, the majority of the celebrities are country music guys.
Right.
And they're also the better players. And, you know, I can't really put my, you know, finger on it. You know, I would say that tempo may have something to do with it. I don't know. But, you know, the last four out of five years, you know, when you get to the million-dollar hole, I've won it. Colt Ford has won it. Mm-hmm. Joe Don from Rascal Flatts won it. And then I think Colt won it again. So 4 out of 5 years, you got country music guys winning against all the celebrities. And then I've also won the celebrity shootout 2 years in a row. And yeah. So, yeah, we love taking our clubs with us. But again, you know, when you're on the road, people think it's glamorous, but it's the part about it that is so great is that 90 minutes that you get on stage, but that's it. The rest of it is just grinding. And like, it's, you know, getting on the bus and not getting good sleep, and very few places have great food. And you're no sleep, no good food, you know, but when you get on stage, man, it's 90 minutes of euphoria, you know, it's utopia, if you will. So golf is probably it is a very healthy distraction that also connects you, even though for a brief moment, it connects you to the community that you're playing in. And I make it, you know, I looked at your, what was your random golf club or whatever it is, the thing that you do where 50 people are playing a hole, and I would not do that. But I love the sentiment of it, that it connects you to the people in that area. And, you know, just like America, you know, we're all Americans, we are, but every little town, man, has its own unique thing. And it's not hard to spot, because, you know, I travel all over the world. I mean, all over the U.S., and I see it like a fingerprint, you know, when I get there. So when I start talking to people on the golf course, you know, from the beverage cart person, you know, to the waiter, to the bartender, to the greenskeeper, to the locals that are playing the course, ask them about holes and different things. And there's this dialogue, you know, that goes on, and you're not going to get that when you're standing on stage. You can't have those conversations. So I'm out there in it. I love one of your comments in that little video. It says, I'm in the golf ball. You know, I don't know if you remember that. being there in that setting with those people is the memory that I'm creating. There are some memories you create on stage, but there's more that you create with individuals at a place, if that makes sense.
That's really interesting. I think about it. Kind of reminds me of, you know, when you're in a car, you're kind of sealed in. But if you're on a motorcycle, you can notice the temperature changes and the smells, and you're just much more aware. And like the way you're describing, I guess, being on tour, when you're just in the truck and, you know, in and out of the venue, and then you step out to go play golf, it's actually what's really going on here. That's not a lot of people use golf in that way that you're talking about, where it's like, it's a way of learning about culture. That's my life, basically.
Well, it's also helped me concentrate, you know, when I get over a shot, you know, learning that there can be downtime in between shots. You know, when I first started playing golf and I got real serious about it, I didn't want anybody interrupting me. I didn't want anybody talking to me. I was like 5 hours, just, you know, and now I'm like, man, I'm just so chill because it's, you know, it's the shot. And you said something else on that little video. You said, you know, nobody cares about your shot. The guys you're playing with don't care about your shot. You get home, nobody cares about the shot. You're the only person that cares about your shot, you know? And why is it so important? Because we're measuring ourselves, you know, and there's just such this deep side. But I've learned to just chillax and relax when I'm playing. And so if someone wants to talk to me in between shots, man, it's great. And there's room, you know? But for the most part, most conversations happen before golf, you know, on the driving range or inside the clubhouse, or when I'm coming off the course and maybe there's fans waiting, or maybe there's just people, locals waiting, and we have conversations. But on the course, man, that 4 hours or 3.5, 4 hours, you know, is such a way to recharge the batteries. And this is true. And I've got lithium batteries, you know, so mine recharge pretty strong. And I get on the stage and I can give it all, man, because I left yesterday out there, you know, and it's brand new, babe.
You talk about recharging your batteries. I feel like a lot of people, if they met you, would have no idea that 24 years ago you were diagnosed with MS. It seems like it's not the right person. It's not you. It's some other guy named Clay Walker.
You know, Eric, golf has been such a huge healer, you know. I first discovered that I had MS. I was playing at Pebble Beach for the first time and in the golf tournament, and I took my club back, and when I did, I felt like this something was electrocuting me in my neck, like not like a pain, but just all over my body. And I was like, golly, I got a pinched nerve or something, you know. And then I didn't think much about it, but it did last the whole tournament. And I got out to Canada on April Fool's Day, April 1st, we were playing to the Saddle Dome, sold out. And that day I went on the basketball court and I just started falling down, and I had double vision, literally it literally looked like the movies, you know, how they show it in the movies. It was that exact way. And I was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis, and my prognosis was horrific. You know, I had so many lesions on my brainstem and brain and spinal cord that the doctor who diagnosed me, it took him all day and night to diagnose me. And he said, I'm sorry. He said, but you're going to be in a wheelchair, you know, in a couple of years, and dead shortly after that. And that was you know, I'm not going to stay in that place right now, but you know, there's a lot of tears, a lot of prayer, a lot of everything. I did start golfing every day after that. And I was very prayerful on the golf course. You know, it was a different time for me. And so I think me and golf, or golf and I, fell in love during that time, because I was able to pray better being walking and away from distractions. You know, I've always looked at golf as very spiritual. And as time went on, I went into what would be called a remission. You know, there's I have relapsing, remitting multiple sclerosis. And so, through a miracle happened, and I have been, you know, relapse free for 20 years. And I can tell you that every day, you know, I've got a, I'll just show you this right here. My office is a mess, but this is across from my desk right there is my chapel. I got this chapel right here where there's an old painting or stained glass from a church in Philadelphia. And then this crucifix came from the mission at Carmel in California. And then I got this old kneeler right here that came from Italy, found it online. And so I come in here every morning. I just start my day out, you know, I say a prayer. And one of my buddies asked me one time, he goes, why do you pray every day? I said, well, I try to pray every day. I said, and if I do, I got half a chance to be a good person. And if I don't, I have no chance, you know. But not to ramble, but the multiple sclerosis piece of it, you know, I can run like the wind right now, which is you know, a miracle in itself. And doctors don't have an explanation for it. They can't. I mean, even the best specialists look at my data and all the information and just go, it's a miracle. They don't really have an answer for it.
I wonder if, I mean, I guess since it's positive news, it doesn't bother you, but I think the scariest thing in life would be to go to a doctor and have them say, we don't know what's wrong.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. And that happens sometimes, you know, people can't get diagnosed and so they don't know what the problem is. They can't fix it, but MS has come a long way, you know, the research and, you know, I have my own tournament now out at Pebble Beach. This will be our 13th annual one coming up in 2021. We had to postpone it this year, or actually cancel it. And so be our 13th one. And one of my good friends, one of my best friends in the world, RJ Harper, who was the director of golf and then a VP at Pebble Beach Company, helped me get the tournament started out there. And he died of pancreatic cancer a couple of years ago. And it's, you know, those great friends, you know, there's not a day that I golf that I don't think about him, and I golf a lot. And I've got a head cover, you know, that when we played AT&T last year, a couple of years ago, they honored RJ by giving all the participants a head cover with his initials on it. And I have it every day. And I think, you know, multiple sclerosis is not all that bad. I could have had pancreatic cancer. And that's one that you don't want to fight. You know, it's just brutal. But multiple sclerosis, I think, honestly, in 10 years, I feel we're going to have it. It's going to be rare that you hear of someone suffering from it. People might still be getting it, but we're going to know how to arrest the disease. And that's what my tournament is about out there, is providing hope for people that have MS, you know, by seeing me golfing and also raising money for to find the cure for it.
Well, that's great. I know a lot of people listening, probably myself, you know, affected by this disease. So, that's a really big deal. I think I'm curious to know more about, you know, you just showed all of us your chapel, and you talked about your prayer that you say in there. Can you tell me a little bit about how, I guess I'm more interested in, you know, you have the prayer, and then as you go throughout the day, do you have a conversation with God throughout the day? What does that sound
all like? All day. Because I fail so much, you know, I think that the biggest misconception about our relationship with God is that we're measuring ourselves up against what we think God is or what God wants for us. And that's the biggest mistake you can make, because, you know, God made us. He knows we're broken. He knows we're so fallible. And when I fail, the thing I try to do immediately is go back into a dialogue with God, because the natural instinct is to not do that, is to hide from it and walk away from it, you know? But I fail multiple times in a day, and I find my relationship is strengthened, you know, through that admittance of that failing and that asking of forgiveness. And I don't picture God as saying you effed up. You know, I picture God as saying, hey Clay, give me another chance.
Oh,
it's almost like he failed. You know, it,
I love that.
And just give me another chance. And I go, you got it. You got it.
There's
preachers out there that are gonna have some pushback against that statement. I mean, I promise you. But you know what? That's to me, it's personal. You know, that relationship is personal. And I can't really find, you know, the God that I know is not, there's not a religion out there right now for me that really gets it all.
Interesting. There isn't, really?
No.
Like, we can talk more about that offline. I'm curious to know, you said golf is a spiritual game. That to me is, that was true for me the moment I first step foot on a golf course, really. And I didn't even know it yet. I actually asked Bill Murray at the AT&T one day. I got a chance to interview him, and I said, is golf a spiritual game? And he didn't say anything for a while. And then finally he said, you know, the whole thing is a spiritual game. So why wouldn't golf be spiritual? And, you know, it was interesting. And I really love that you recognize how spiritual the game of golf is. I'm curious to know more about that, you know, and I don't want to direct you too much. I feel like where would you take that subject further?
Well, to layer on to the Bill Murray comment, Bill and I have played golf together more than once, you know, a few times, and a couple times we've actually won the celebrity shootout together. So I wouldn't say we're best friends, but we've had dinner together, just the two of us, drinks, different things. But in one of my earliest years of playing AT&T, I was very nervous. You know, you're man, there are tens of thousands of fans on every hole, and you know, Bill Murray's bigger than life there, you know, because of Caddyshack, among other things, and he's endeared himself to, you know, to everyone there, you know, and not the least of which are the fans. And if most people who have followed the AT&T for a while would recall him literally pulling a woman, an older lady, down into a sand trap, you know, or bunker, whatever you want to call it. So on the 18th hole, he took her out of the stand. She comes up, Bill, I love you. And he pulled her right down on her back into the sand. I'd be sued for everything I own if I did something like that, right? Only Bill Murray could get away with this. And I'm watching this play out. And I'm like, I'm mortified. She loved the fact that Bill Murray drug her down on her back. Her hair's all in the sand. She didn't even care. It was the greatest thing ever. And I watch, and then he picks her up, he kisses her, she walks off just all flustered and everything. I'm going, how does he do that? You know, Clint Eastwood couldn't have done that, right? And so just before we're about to putt out, a group, we always get introduced to kids who are facing some challenges, which I think is great of the AT&T. And one of the little boys had cancer. He was probably, I don't know, maybe 8 years old, and he had no hair. And he just loves Bill Murray. And Bill Murray bent down, took a picture with him, hugged on him, kissed on him. I mean, just loved him. And so then Bill and I are walking up to get onto the green on 18. We're going to win the tournament that day. And we're walking up there together. And we've been together all day long, you know. And I looked over at him, and I said, Bill, we're shoulder to shoulder. And I said, was that little boy terminal? And he shot me a look that would have just stopped a freight train. And he says, no one's terminal. And it resonated. I didn't say another word. His look said everything. It told me he's deeply spiritual. And so it matches up with what you said. He says, the whole thing is spiritual. So why wouldn't golf just be part of that? That's a beautiful story. And to answer your question, yes, I find golf is, you can either see spirituality in it or not. It's the way that you choose it. But I feel like it's much more interesting, much more rewarding, much more self-gratifying, and improves your relationships with other people. When you look, you said this in one of your comments on this, I keep going back to this video of you. You said that it makes you learn about yourself, and the way you treat yourself on the golf course is the way you're going to treat others. You couldn't have said a more profound statement than that. And golf literally has made me a much kinder, gentler, better human being. And I find that playing it with people, mainly people that I care about, deepens my relationship and bonds with them. You know, I have three sons, soon to have four, and my daughter too. My daughter Mary, she's 10. We all golf together, and it's the greatest experience. You know, we've never played 18 holes. You know, I have kids all the way from 12 to 2, And it's about the time, man. It's about those moments spent there and hitting great shots. I've never seen one of my children get mad on the golf course. And, you know, it's because it's always been a place, one, of reverence. You know, when we get on the green, I teach the kids, hey, this is a holy ground. You know, you can tear up the earth everywhere else, but when you get on the green, this is holy ground. You know, take off your shoes. No.
That's good training. I like that.
It's helped a lot. And but you know, and offline, I'd love to have that conversation. We should play 9 or 18 holes together sometime. And I know you're a world traveler, and you've been in a lot of different countries, experienced a lot of things, seen a lot of different things. But there's a common thread, you know, through mankind. And there's a common thread that runs through just about all golfers who really do respect the game. And I've seen that everywhere. And I think golf is a pretty good religion.
I love that. I mean, I think one of the things that I'd love to see more of, you know, across the golf community would be, like you just said, like recognizing the similarities between us. I mean, you know, the landscape of golf, the game of golf, the group aspect of it, it's such a great opportunity to see through all of the BS that is outside the world, you know. I remember like one time we were in Dubai and I was asking about why they wear basically the white sheet, you know, the Candora. And they were like, it equalizes everybody. There's no, I mean, you can wear a watch, sure, but there's no Gucci, there's no, you know what I mean? It's kind of a leveling thing. And golf does that too. I mean, I'm sure you played with billionaires that would give anything to just get out of the sand trap, you know, or, you know what I mean? And then there's some kid who's just kind of like, most of the people on the PGA Tour, the female and male pro golfers came from, you know, they weren't going to country clubs as a kid. They were going to the public driving range. That's so interesting to me.
Well, you know, golf is not about perfect. You know, it's about getting it up and down. And, you know, that's why the pros spend 65-70% of their time on short game, because they know they're going to miss 9 greens. And sometimes they're going to hit it stiff and make birdie, but 50% of the time they're going to miss a green. And so it's really about minimizing mistakes and having the grit and determination to put that ball in the hole. And that's what I see out of the pros that I don't see out of, you know, almost every amateur. A pro misses a green and he's thinking, I'm going to hold it out for birdie. Like literally he thinks I'm going to hold it out for birdie. And if he skulls it over the green, the next one, he says, I'm going to make par. I mean, literally that's what they're telling you know, amateurs go, I just want to get it on the green.
Yeah, you know? I'm happy with whatever. So,
yeah, there's a determination when they were something. I think all of them possess this, and that is they want to get the ball in the damn hole. And I mean now. They want to get it in there on the first shot. When they hit it off the tee, they wish they could hit it in the hole. And, you know, I have border collies. I have 5 border collies. And I promise you, when you let my border collies out, they want to go one place, straight to the cow pasture. They want to work a cow. I mean, it's like holding back a freight train trying to keep my dogs from going to the cow pasture. And they're disciplined with it like golfers are. But to me, that's what golfers are like, border collies. Man, they're smart, and they got one thing on their mind, that's get it in the damn hole.
How did you get 5? Was it 4 not enough? And then you were like, I need a 5th one, or did you have a litter or what? I mean,
yeah, it works like this. When you have one daughter, you know, in the household, she's not gonna let you get rid of the puppies. I mean, that's just how it happened. I mean, it was brutal, man. I mean, like, you know, I listen to her, my wife, that's who runs the household. That's how we ended up with 5, but we got, they're really great dogs, and I love animals. Now I love dogs especially, and they bring a lot of joy. There used to be this golf course, it still is, I guess, but in Oklahoma, called Oak Tree, and they had 2 courses there. You know, they had the one of the member side, and then one was the man side. You know, they literally had a golf course that was just for men only. And I remember this is early on in my music career. They let me on that side. So I went to go play. And I saw a guy playing golf barefoot in his boxer shorts with his border collie out on the golf course. And I thought, this is heaven. This is heaven on earth, man. You got to be kidding me.
I love that. We need more of that in golf, right?
Man, yeah, they did a woman's course the same way, you know, have one for the women, you know. Unfortunately, it'd probably be a bunch of peeping toms.
Yeah, walls.
Yeah, exactly. But that's really, man, I can say that, you know, I would be so much less fulfilled without golf in my life. And I actually, you know, thought that MS was going to take that away from me. You know, that was one of my worst fears. I'll be honest with you. I didn't think about losing my voice or not being able to walk on stage. I thought MS is going to take golf away from me. And it was a horrible, defeating feeling. And it's done anything but that. You know, there have been times in my life where I was a really low, low single digit handicapper. And that's what I'm looking forward to now is, I haven't lost a lot of distance. You know, I'm 51 and, you know, I feel my strength is still there, you know, and I still got great coordination. And I would like to get down to scratch. You know, that would be a really good goal for me. And I've been close before. I used to play a lot of golf out at Champions in Houston with Steve Elkington, who I think, you know, has the most rhythmic and functional and beautiful swing that there ever has been, you know.
Yeah.
And he's also a funny Australian. You know, if you don't know him, he has this thing called Secret Golf, which is, you know, just the bomb. But you know, having a lot of the enigmas taken away out of the game for me is what I see. And it's the same way with religion. You know, if we can compare those two, I think you're kind of a spiritual person, so I don't mind interjecting, you know, those comments every now and then. But enigmas to me are killers of the truth. And there are some truths that are objective and they can be known in both golf and religion. But using golf for a minute, you know, Steve taught me something that 99.9, and I literally mean that, 99.9 of golfers never know this. Your hands need to be slightly ahead of the golf ball at impact. And when you look down the shaft at the ball, there's an optical illusion there. And when you look at it, your hands look like that they're even with the ball, but they're actually behind it. And this is why 99.9% of the golfers scoop the ball or hit it fat. They don't understand that to have your hands actually out there, either even with the ball or slightly ahead of it, it's going to look like it's that far out there.
Right.
And so that's the first thing Steve did with me when he started teaching me. And, you know, it literally knocked 10 strokes off of my game immediately. Not like got to learn it.
How long have you been playing? What was your handicap at the time?
I was probably about a 17 when I met Steve, and I went from 17 to 9 instantly, and then Steve said, he goes, we got in the bunker and he drew a line in the sand, and he said, yeah, he said, I want you to straddle this line. He goes, and I want you to hit this line. I want you to go from you can hit it 10 times with every club. He says, we'll get out here and hit some balls. So about 4 hours later, I never hit the line 10 times with every club. It did not happen. I was completely and utterly exhausted. And I said, man, I said, I'm not going to do this anymore. I said, I feel stupid anyway. I said, look at everybody else who's up there hitting on. And he looked at me and he goes, that's the difference between pros and amateurs. He says, pros know you have to be able to hit that line. And so I stayed in that line and I stayed in there. And Steve and I, I played golf with him almost every day at Champions that he wasn't on tour. I wasn't on tour. We played together every day. And in those memories, to me, that set my foundation. So my understanding of golf in the golf swing is probably above average, thanks to him. And, you know, I'll never be a pro golfer. But the enigmas that got taken out of it, that's one of the things that made me relax, you know, as a person. And I, you know, in going back to religion, you know, there are some things that we can know, and they live inside of every human being. You know, we know the difference between good and evil. You know, that's in us. You know, we don't need a religion to teach us that. You know, God put that in us. And, you know, I definitely believe in intelligent design. I'm like, how could you not? You know, it's like, I love one of the old analogies. You know, if you think this is random, why don't you put a canvas out in a pasture, you know, with all the paints, the most greatest paints in the world, and anchor it to the ground and come back in 3 million years and see if there's a Mona Lisa there, you know, or something that, I mean, you know, so, I got to believe that with the beauty, you know, I've never seen anything worth having that wasn't worth working for or had some work put into it. And so, you know, I just think when I look at golf and I look at the surroundings, I look at the natural things we would call natural, I do see the design in them, you know, and I want to believe that, you know, when my body, you know, goes lifeless, that I'm still living and that I'm not in a different place, but just continue a journey that I get to learn, you know, for billions of years. You know, I just want to learn everything. And I'm like, there's no way with this brain of mine that I would be so sad if I don't get to go learn all the stuff that I don't have time to learn. I mean, like in my life, you know, I started taking welding lessons 3 years ago and I just wanted to be a great welder. And I'm not a great welder, but I'm a really good welder. And I just wanted to understand, you know, looking through that lens in the hood, you know, looking at melding those things together, watching these metals and picking the right rod and et cetera, and understanding it. You know, I have horses, you know, I have 15 horses and they're performance bred and I work with them all the time, training them, learning them, and trying to understand their instincts, you know, versus mine, and moving them around and getting control of them where I can enjoy them. You know, I find all that spiritual and writing a song, you know, looking at words, knowing that there are only so many words in the English dictionary, you know, and I've got to come up with a formulation of those words that are going to make people feel something. It doesn't matter how crafty it is or that isn't what people care about. They want that thing that touches them. And most of the time that's going to be in the human voice. It doesn't matter if you're a great singer. And this is another thing I have discovered, that people absolutely can detect. I call it the EQ, you know, not IQ, but the EQ. People detect sincerity, honesty, and you can't fake it. There is no way to fake it. So all of that to say that, you know, I'm a work in progress, and I look every day, you know, and I see God every single day of my life, and I talk to God every day of my life.
And that's I mean, that's the goal, right? I mean, that's the goal, really.
All right. ExpressVPN. When you use the bathroom, you always close the door behind you, right? Whoa, this is a weird ad all of a sudden. You don't want random passersby looking in on you, so why would you let people look in on you when you go online? Honestly, I know what you do online, and I would definitely shut the door behind you. Using the internet without ExpressVPN is like going to the bathroom and not closing the door. Did you know that your internet service provider like Comcast knows every single website you visit? Wow, I didn't know that. I'm going to leave the country. What's worse, What's worse is that they can sell this information to ad companies who can use your data to target you. ExpressVPN puts a stop to this. STOP, like a stop sign. It creates a secure encrypted tunnel. And who doesn't love a tunnel? I love tunnel. I'm a tunnel fan. I'm into tunneling. It sounds like I mean something that I don't mean, but what I mean is I like tunnels. Anyway, between your device and the internet so that your online activity can't be seen by anyone. I use ExpressVPN on all my devices. And the best part is ExpressVPN, it's as easy as closing the bathroom door. Booyah. And it's soundproof. What? Call to action. So if you're like me and you believe your online activity is your business, secure yourself by visiting expressvpn.com/Eric today. Use my exclusive link, express, expressvpn.com/Eric, and you get an extra 3 months free. Dude, that's a quarter of a year. Anyway, check it out, expressvpn.com/Eric. All right, folks, real quick, Theragun. This is a new ad read, and it's coming from a fan. I am into the Theragun. Okay, feel free to ad-lib the introduction with personalized copy or start with below. The stress of daily life weighs on us all. Whether you're an elite athlete or just a regular person like you and me, trying to get through the day, muscle pain and tension is a real thing. So here's the deal. You can try, I use Theragun. It's a handheld percussive therapy device that releases your deepest fears. I mean, muscle tension, using a scientifically calibrated combination of depth, speed, and power. Wow. That's a mouthful, a handful, and basically a muscle full. So anyway, that's because the all new Gen 4 Theragun has a proprietary brushless motor that's so quiet. Italicized this part is, you will wonder if it is even on. While you soothe your aching muscles with Theragun's signature power, amplitude, and effectiveness. So anyway, I do love my Theragun. I've had it now for 2 years. I got a replacement once. Oh, they came out with a newer one, and I was like, send me the newer one. And they sent it to me very nicely, and I always have it in my bag. So anyway, try it for 30 days. No substitute for the Theragun Gen 4 with an OLED screen, personalized Theragun app, and the quiet and power you need. Starting at only $169. Did you know it's only $169, Bo?
I did.
That's a fucking deal. I got to say it right there. Go to Theragun.com/Eric right now and get your Gen 4 Theragun today. That's Theragun.com/Eric. 30 days. No substitute. Anyway, Theragun.com/Eric.
I mean, we got to play golf. We have to play golf. How often are you playing these days?
I play 2 or 3 days a week.
Okay.
And I used to play 5 every week minimum, sometimes 7, but 5 times a week. And yeah, you're in Austin. You got some great golf courses there. I'll come down, and we can go play wherever you want, and pick your best course, and we'll play 36.
I love it. Yeah, I've been now that I'm here in Austin, I got a little more space, and I was kind of thinking, like, you know, it was interesting to hear you talk about welding and horses, because I'm like thinking about what the next hobby is going to be. Like, I gotta find a new hobby. I don't know if it's going to be welding, but what do you think?
Well, welding is safer than horses. just some degree. But you know, I read a lot, you know, I read pretty much every day, and I find myself looking at YouTube videos of people who are centenarians, you know, because I find it fascinating, you know, and some of the common threads, you know, they have, you know, 1 or 2 adult beverages every day with friends and family.
Interesting.
It's important, right? So you and I could actually adopt each other, you know, as relatives. If we're drinking together, that means we're extending our lifespan, you know. And
I love that.
Overall, they had a connection to ancestors. You know, that they either had a room in the house or a place in their home where they had pictures of loved ones, you know, deceased and living, and they felt connected, you know? And, you know, that's one of the things that religion does for me. I lost my dad when he was only 62, and it affected me in a deep way because he was diagnosed with cancer and he was dead in 2 weeks. And that was such a shock. I would thought my dad would live to be 100. And so, you know, that it left an indelible memory on me. And so I feel him around me every day too. You know, I can not audibly in my ear hear him speak to me, but I can feel what he would say to me if he was standing there, you know, and it gives me a lot of joy to feel connected, you know, and I don't think we're ever truly separated from our loved ones. I don't subscribe to that. And again, on the golf course, the strangest thing happened to me. I was reading this book. I think it was called Utopia. It was a book about a golfer who had, he was a new pro, just turned pro. And it was a big book, you know, back in the, 10 or 11, 12 years ago. You probably remember the book. They made a movie about it too. And you didn't know if he made the putt. But it's something like Golf Utopia. It's something.
Seven Days in Utopia, I think.
Seven. That's it. Yes. Yeah. Exactly. I read that book and we were in Hawaii, and it was my first time ever to Hawaii. And we were sitting out in Kapalua Beach on the lawn there. We had a really great place. And I was reading that book. And the next week we were headed to Pebble Beach for me to play in the AT&T. And the guy in the book kind of runs away from golf and finds this golf course, you know, somewhere out in the middle of nowhere. And the old man starts teaching him some things about golf that he didn't realize, the spiritual side of golf. And on one of the holes in the book, the new golfer, is, you know, he'd been angry, he broke his clubs, all this kind of stuff. And so he gets to this hole and he sees a grave. And I had this weird feeling come over me about my dad. And I literally started, you know, crying. I just felt, I was just this weird thing. I'm not a crier. I told my wife about it. And 3 days later, when we got to Pebble Beach, I got the call that my dad had cancer and was in the hospital. And, you know, I was just, there's just no way that you can just say, oh, that's just coincidence, you know? And so, even more so when I play golf now, you know, there's even a deeper connection. So it just keeps going with me. And I think when you're open to it, you know, that the cosmos and I call it God and the angels and all the heavenly hosts, you know, for me, I know some people think differently. I don't deprive anybody of their spiritual beliefs by any means or begrudge them of it. But I feel, man, I just think that there's, when you're open to it, you're going to see signs and you're going to feel things that are very supernatural and they scare people sometimes, but if you're really open to it, it should excite you.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's, first of all, beautiful story, I think. And I'm sorry to hear about your father.
I'm okay, because I know he's okay. You know, it took me a while. It took me 6 months, you know, to actually stop crying.
Sure, I can imagine.
No, but now it's like the greatest thing, man. It's like this beautiful circle. You know, I know one day it'll be my time, and I also know that my kids are going to be okay. You know, they'll be okay, because and I'm gonna let, you know, they know that story about my dad. And you know, we talk about him all the time. You know, I have his tractor here and a lot of his tools, his axes, you know, knives, different things, and we all use them. You know, they're not put away like, oh, this is sacred, nobody can touch it. They're used, you know, because that's what my dad wanted. He wanted to be used, not put away. But thank you for saying that. I'm blessed, you know, that I got 2 weeks, you know, by his bedside with some of the greatest conversation. My dad was not religious at all. My dad never went to church. I never saw him. He never took me to church. We never hardly talked about, you know, a God, much less specifically God. And on his deathbed, it was the coolest thing, you know, ever. Of course, I was devastated, and there were moments that I would be by his side, and I asked him if he believed in heaven. And he took, like, I don't know, like you were talking about Bill Murray taking a while to answer you. My dad took, like, I don't know, 60 seconds, which is an awkward amount of time for silence, right?
That's too long.
And he said, I think it's there. He said, for each one of us to know individually. And I was like, man, what book is he even reading? You know, I was wondering what's going on in that head of his, you know. And I said, I took the leap of faith, you know, and I asked him, I said, do you believe in God? He took even longer this time to answer me. And he said, I do. He said, but I believe in the devil too, son. He said, and you can't outrun that son of a bitch. And I mean, just as cold. It came piercing right through the air, man. When he said that to me, it blew my hair backwards. I was like, wow. And, you know, I pressed in a little harder. And at first, I didn't realize the magnitude of the words. And I get now, I live differently because of his answer. I ask him if he was right with God. And in the most piercing way, he looked at me pupil to pupil and he says, that ain't between you and me, boy. And I thought, does he have some guilt on him? Is he bothered by something? Maybe I pressed something sensitive, you know? And so I thought, and I waited about maybe 5 minutes, and I'm still sitting there after he said that, you know, and there's just, I didn't respond to it. And then I got the true message. I said to him, because I thought at this time, this was the right thing. I said, Dad, we don't know what the outcome is going to be here for you. I said, but I want you to know, you know, if indeed it's your time, I said, I want you to know that I'm right with God. And here came the answer. He said, that ain't between you and me, boy. He was telling me, he knew he was leaving. He knew he was dying. But he wanted me to know that there's not a more sacred relationship than that one. And he's had it his whole life. And it was none of my damn business. So when somebody comes up to me and asks me, am I saved? Those are going to be my words. That ain't between you and me.
Right.
It's that personal.
And
I look at God in a much different way now, you know, because of my dad was teaching me all the way into his death, right, and all the way past his death. He's still teaching me. I'm still learning from a lot of those words that were said on that deathbed. And I want to tell you, that was a blessing. Cancer was a blessing that my dad didn't just get taken like that. And I didn't get to hear some of these profundities that have shaped and blessed me, you know, 10, 11 years later, 12 years, 2011, you know, 9 years later. And I'm, man, I'm just, I'm sorry to take up all the time saying that, but I
no, it's a great story. I mean, it strikes me that, you know, the gratitude that you have to be able to, you know, talk to your dad in that way, I'll bet a lot of people say that to you about your songs and your lyrics. I mean, you obviously have written some, you know, profound stories, and some of them even like, I imagine that people come to you and say something like that. What do you hear that really resonates with you from a fan of your work? What are you like, wow, that's incredible. Is there some common thread?
You always get, if you've had some hits, you know, most artists will get it when someone tells them that a particular song, the words of it, you know, affected them in a certain way. And I think that's very objective and wonderful. You never get tired of hearing that. It's like someone telling, you know, you think a woman ever gets tired of you telling her she's beautiful? No. even if they're like, oh, you're just saying that. They don't care. Look, they never get tired of hearing
it. Keep saying it.
A singer never gets tired of hearing someone say, at least I don't, that there's something about my voice that moves them. My voice, not the words, the actual voice.
Interesting.
That's the greatest, you know, feeling of what you say, what resonates, because, you know, voice is not about words. It's about sound. And the more pure sound you can make, that's to me the greatest accomplishment of a singer is what is your sound of your voice. Can you get the most purity out of it? It's kind of like, can I hit a shot on the center of the club face? Because that produces the most distance, right? You know, here I go back to the analogy, but it's literally, you know, I compare golf and singing 100%. They both have to be rhythmic to be great. And at the moment of truth, which is the moment of truth, the impact zone is where it counts. You can have all kinds of styles, Jim Furyk, you know, all these swings, moment of impact, same way with singing. You've got to squash the ball at the moment of impact. You got to put it on the inside quadrant, hand slightly ahead, and compress it.
I like that. That's the real craft of it all. I think that's because also that's probably in the moment. If someone's listening to you in the moment, it's not even about the words. It's about the sounds. And that's interesting. That's interesting. Have you ever heard someone do a karaoke version of one of your songs and been like?
Well, I don't do karaoke anymore because
you can't.
My piano player, who is like the karaoke king, he asked me to go to a karaoke bar with him one night, and so I went in, and this is probably, I don't know, 15 years ago, and I had written a song that was a number one hit called "Rumor Has It," and it was at the karaoke thing, and I heard someone do it, you know, and so I did. So I waited about an hour, and I said, "Hey, I'm going to do "Rumor Has It," you know, and so I go up there. Now, remember, we had just played a sold-out arena in Denver, right? And we're going partying afterwards.
Amazing.
We walk in a place where they have country music fans. I get on stage, no cowboy hat or anything, and I sing "Rumor Has It," song I actually wrote too, right? I come off the stage feeling pretty good about the way I'd sang it, and this woman, you know, she's probably, you know, 40, late 30s, 40 years old. She looks at me and she goes, "Pretty good." She goes, "You're no Clay Walker." And so I go on past her, and man, like, I'm really thinking, was she joking with me? And some other guy, there's two guys sitting over here, and one of the guys goes, But no, that's not him. He said, that's not him. He goes, Clay Walker's taller than that and a lot better looking. And I'm like, yeah. And I told Van, I said, this ruined my confidence. I'm not saying karaoke again. I'm dead serious. That was it, man. I was done.
That is too good. No karaoke for Clay Walker. That's too good. Oh my goodness. Yeah, actually, I'm not a very good singer, but the first time I did karaoke, I didn't really know what was going on. And so I go in and I pick Billy Joel, one of my favorite singers, right? And I pick New York State of Mind because it's one of my favorite songs. I didn't realize it's a 7-minute song with like no backing. And I mean, it's just terrible. It's horrendous.
Well, you know what? I think I'll dust off my karaoke boots, you know, and if you'll sing too, we'll pick I'm dead serious, and we'll video it. Okay. After a round of golf, make it 18 then instead, you know, make it 18 instead of 36. We'll go out and do that. But man, overall, man, my career has been so fulfilling. And, you know, I'm, you know, during this, like every other singer, it's weird not being on stage. It'll be a year, you know, for me when I'm, if that or more before I'm able to get on stage. I've never gone this long in my entire career since I started without doing a concert. So it's, man, there's a lot of rust to knock off for everyone. I think the entertainers are growing very restless, you know, and of course we really don't know. We don't know. I mean, I see stuff. There's so much confusion out there about, you know, about this stuff. But I know that it's real. We don't know what the extent of it is. But I want to get out there and sing. My career's been so blessed. And I am thankful to have a new record deal, you know, on Toby Keith's record label called Show Dog. And the early indications are that this new song we have, We All Need a Bar Sometime, is going to be a hit. And that's fun, you know,
yeah.
Knowing that you could come out, you know, and still win, you know, PGA Tour event when you're over 50. You know, that's when you do that, you're just pretty impressive. You know that.
I love that. I love that, man. Well, that's great. I mean, Clay, thank you so much for your time. Thanks for all you've done for the world of golf and MS and country music, and I'm looking forward to a duet, I guess. I mean, I have no business anywhere near you on any stage, but karaoke would be fun, and yeah, I'm looking forward to playing golf too.
What is your current handicap or index?
It's about 6. What about you?
I think 7.
Oh, okay. We could make some money together, you know, depending. Do you gamble usually on the course or no?
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely. Yes.
I mean, you know, you can't talk Vince Gill into gambling. He won't gamble on the golf course, but I certainly will. You know, I mean, got to play for something, you know, that leaks. That's my philosophy. I've never asked him why he won't, you know, twice. but I would love to play for something, and no matter what it is, like beer, money.
Yeah.
Another chance for an interview. Hey, let me give you my phone number and you can text me.
Yeah.
And I'll have yours. And I do come to Texas a lot. So.